Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Britt Edelin, and today I am joined by Gila Ashtore. Hello, Gila. So today we are talking about Gila Ashtore and her new book, and I'll introduce her. So Gila is a critical theorist, psychoanalyst, and writer, and teacher at Columbia University. And today we're going to be talking about her new book, Homo Psyche, on Queer Theory and Erotophobia. It was a great read, super interesting, brings up a lot of really intense questions. And so I'm really excited to talk about it with you today. So welcome to the show, and I'm so excited to talk to you. So my first question for you is a little bit of personal background. And so I just want to ask, you know, how did you come to thinking about this and thinking in general? And how did this book come about?
Thank you, first of all, Britt, for having me. I've listened to many of your interviews and find them always very interesting. So thanks for including me. How did I come to this? You know, as I mentioned in the book, I did my master's degree with Lauren Berland and my PhD with Lee Edelman, and learned a lot firsthand, felt like I had a front row seat to a lot of these theories and how some of the best thinkers of some of this work have thought things through. I adored them and was fascinated by the work they were doing. And it also, for all that, though, left me feeling like there were severe limitations to some of these ideas, and that they sounded good or they were very appealing, but something was really missing. And I think that the book is really an attempt to figure out what is that thing that's missing, what is not, what is absent from some of these really stunning formulations. And so I think it's, in some sense, a work of real admiration for a lot of the thinkers that I engage with, but also a lot of conflict. And I try not to shy away from that. I try to sort of embrace that, because I do believe that's sort of the spirit of queer theory anyway. And I wanted to push the field to push the field with me to wonder about what might be missing and how could we make things work differently, have new thoughts.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I really appreciated about your book is the kind of cursory, obviously, history of queer theory that you give, especially because it shows how, I think, internally divided and critical queer theory always has been and always will be, almost as like a constitutive part of what it is, because I don't know. So I'm an English literature person, and reading queer theory, like queer theory as a discipline, is just made of so many different people from so many different backgrounds. So it's really such an interesting and dynamic space to think in. And so I your interventions are, you know, you're making an intervention, but that's part of queer theory.
Yeah, I think it's interesting you say that about the history. I think that one of the effects of being, about my own history of being a student of it, is you sort of don't have a concept of the history of the field when you're sort of studying it. You're like, this is just the field. This is just the world. There is no history. It's just always been like this, and it will always be like this. And I think part of what I find very encouraging is more recent work, really, in the past 10 years, to try to take a little perspective on the field and wonder about, like, does it need to be this way? What can we do that will still keep it queer theory, but that cannot be so wedded to some of its more popular formulations about itself? I think that article Indifferences that I cite a lot about anti-normativity and the sort of frustration with how routine that's become is one, I think, major emblem of that kind of wish to push the field a little bit while still keeping it queer theory. But I think that's part of the question.
So I think Before we get into a deeper discussion, I, in all of my podcast episodes, I think I like to start with the title because, you know, the title is something that's so important. When I first read it, Homo Psyche, I'm wondering how you read it or how you would propose to read it, because on the one hand, you can think of it as like the psyche of the homo, and that's obviously something that you're doing. And thinking about the psychology, the psychoanalytic dimension. But I also read it immediately as kind of this alternative to Homo sapiens. So there is this kind of, I think, a bridge that you're building between kind of a question of subjectivity that psychoanalysis is trying to always get at, as well as something specifically queer or homo about all of these issues. Maybe can you just say how you're thinking of it?
Yeah, I think you said it perfectly. I think that's exactly right. I think, partly I think there's it's trying to do two things at once, the title. I think there's an internal division in the field between those who want queerness to represent the sort of end of subjectivity in some sense. And it's like beyond the human, beyond subjectivity, even beyond consciousness. Partly it's repudiation of that, and it's saying, we need the psyche for queerness. We're not getting rid of it. That doesn't work. It's not going to check out in some of the ways I try to show. But I think secondly, and more importantly, it is to what you're saying, I think it's an attempt to insist on my part that the psyche is sexual, that the psyche, at its fundamental core, the way it's constructed is sexual. And that's where Laplanche comes in for me. As I see him intervening in psychoanalysis to try to really make that argument that even psychoanalysis does not really take that far enough, it's not like there's a field that's doing it and queer theory is behind. It's actually a genuinely difficult thing to keep in one's head in a certain sense. And so I think that's the nature of what I'm trying to say with that.
So we'll definitely get to the sexual. I think that's kind of the big question of the text. And before we do that, I want to move to the subtitle of the book, maybe to give us a little more of a context for listeners. So it's On Queer Theory and Erotophobia. Can you kind of sketch out maybe when you say queer theory, what does this mean and how should we think about it as a discipline or as an institutional body? And then what is erotophobia?
Yeah. I think of, queer theory is many different things to many different people. And I'm not interested in like, this is the one true queer theory versus the others. But definitely the tradition that I'm working in, the tradition within queer theory, is much more the version of it that's interested in sexuality as it pertains to subjectivity and to consciousness, I would say. I think of that as really being traced to Sedgwick, maybe most powerfully. She's maybe the figure for me that I think is most interested in these, in molding queer theory in this way. So I would say that's the version of it that that the book is engaged in. And I think, erotophobia I'm defining as a kind of denial of sexuality as, and here I'm defining what I mean by sexuality as intrusive, intersubjective, and exogenous. And so I think that how I'm defining sexuality is very important to the word erotophobia, because it doesn't mean that, It's a certain redefinition of sexuality that I'm trying to get at in order to then explain why I think a lot of the field's formulations are erotophobic. But I don't think it's in any obvious way. And I think that's why two things need to happen. I think first, sexuality needs to be redefined. That's where Laplanche comes in for me. And once sexuality is redefined, then we can see where our thinking about it is erotophobic.
So the erotophobic thesis, I think, was something that was so interesting because it was so non-intuitive.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that when we think of queer theory, we're thinking of, you know, like a very sexual or like really interrogating the sexual and what mm-hmm. place it has in the subject, in the individual, as well as in societies. And I think like that's how we want to think about it. But you've shown so much through this book that there are ways that this thinking is not actually what is happening, or that your definition of erotophobic is what is coming out in a lot of these theories. And we'll talk about that later. But you've brought up La Planche a few times now, and I think that is the grounding figure, your primary interlocutor. So can you, just as another contextualizing gesture, maybe explain a little bit about La Planche and his thinking, especially in relation to psychoanalysis, in how, like, when someone says psychoanalysis, you're going to think of Freud, right? But a lot of other people are going to think of Lacan as well. How does La Planche come into a constellation with those two as kind of disrupting this normative view of psychoanalysis?
Yeah, I think, you know, just for some very basic history, you know, La Planche was a student of Lacan's and also an analysand of Lacan. And he really, at the beginning of his career, was very much devoted himself to a very close reading of Freud. He didn't really criticize Freud that much, and he didn't criticize Lacan that much. And there was a, you know, very well-known conference at Bonneval in 1959, I believe, when La Planche and Leclerc really challenged Lacan in a very important way. Lacan was furious. He stormed out. And that was sort of maybe the beginning of this break. And afterwards, later, more like 60s, 70s, and even more so increasingly La Planche in, you know, 70s, 80s, and afterward, up until, you know, the 90s, he died in 2012, really became increasingly critical, both of Freud and of Lacan. He didn't formulate his criticism of Lacan in a very comprehensive way. It's more embedded in some of these texts, and he uses a lot of Lacan while at the same time challenging him. And in terms of his relationship to Freud, you know, La Planche very much considers himself both faithful and unfaithful to Freud. He really believes that Freud had an intuition about sexuality, which was correct. But then Freud and many analysts after him sort of, what he uses the term, going astray. They lost their way. They thought they set out to analyze sexuality. They set out to grasp sexuality, but lo and behold, instead, they turned it into an instinct, or they turned it into the environment, or they ended up going down all these paths, because it's actually very hard to grasp sexuality in its form. And so he's a very unique figure. There's no school of La Planchians. He also writes very little about the clinical domain. He doesn't really write about patients. He's much more a philosopher by training and an analyst. I think he sees himself much more as a critic that is trying to correct a lot of these mistakes that psychoanalysis keeps making. And so, first of all, with respect to queer theory, that's a long way of saying that, you know, queer theory is not alone in sort of going, starting out with a wish to talk about sexuality or be the discipline that is most interested in interrogating it. Psychoanalysis sees itself that way too, in many ways, and certainly sees itself as being very brave in some of its formulations about the psyche. And yet, I think, according to La Planche, about psychoanalysis, and for me, a similar thing with queer theory, that there's a way that this keeps getting lost. There's a way that the impulse to really understand this keeps going astray. for both fields, queer theory and psychoanalysis, but this book is really about how queer theory does that.
Yeah, and I mean, maybe you can say a little more now to kind of go back to an earlier point and something that you bring up throughout the book is this relation between queer theory and psychoanalysis. Because I think, I mean, there was a huge boom of thinking about it, but then it kind of seems like people want to distance themselves from psychoanalysis as a way of thinking about the queer subject. How do you see this history, and like, what is, why bring, what's the gesture to bring it back, and why in a specifically Laplanchian in mode?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was on a panel last month with Elizabeth Wilson, and she was complaining that graduate students these days are just so anti-psychoanalytic. They come in and they're like, ugh, we're done. We like don't care anymore. It's already, we don't need it. It's irrelevant. And they have these ideas about what psychoanalysis, and she's like, ugh. Like, I spend the whole semester trying to get them to like interrogate their aversion to it or understand where this came from. And it feels kind of hopeless because they're just so settled in their, you know, distance from psychoanalysis. I mean, I guess one question I have even before answering that is, I wonder if that resonates with you. Is that something you see? Like, I'd be curious to hear your experience of it, actually.
Yeah, I can kind of completely agree with that. So I'm a graduate student doing psychoanalysis, and I feel like a lot of my colleagues are kind of, I mean, I think part of it is due to this whole post-critical turn.
Yeah.
And this idea that, you know, psychoanalysis is kind of this dead subject, and it doesn't, it's been done, and we have new things to say. But I do think a lot of people come at it not actually having ever read Freud or Lacan, or definitely not Laplanche.
Yeah.
Or even other psychoanalytic thinkers. So there's a whole, like, I don't know, once you get told once by some professor that Freud was a misogynist or whatever, I feel like there's this allergic reaction to psychoanalysis when, you know, psychoanalysis is so huge. Like, there's so many different ways to go into it. It's not just Freudian. It's not just Lacanian. There's so much to do. And I think a lot of people just don't have that or don't know.
Yeah.
So that's my experience.
That's your, it's interesting. I mean, Elizabeth Wilson was talking about Tompkins. You know, she just wrote a book on Tompkins, and she was talking about affect and Tompkins, and saying, like, here's another way to do psychoanalysis. Like, there are so many ways, and Tompkins had his own very contentious relationship to Freud and to Freudian psychoanalysis. So the fact that they would be in the same category is itself interesting. But yes, I mean, I think in some sense, my question always for this disregard of psychoanalysis is, what do you use otherwise? Like, you know, Laplanche is such a critic of Freud. I mean, he's unrelenting about what Freud gets wrong. So I don't know who, I guess I'm not in particular like sympathetic to people that are trying to bring back Freud in some originary form. I don't even know what that would look like. I'm not even sure what version of psychoanalysis is defensible, you know, in its earliest formulations. It's all been so critiqued and overturned anyway, that we're sort of on very different ground than we were, you know, in the 1920s. So I'm, you know, but I'm not sure. I always wonder, for the people that don't want psychoanalysis because they're tired of thinking about the psyche or the subject in a certain way, well, then what do we use to think about the experience?
Yeah, I have.
I'm like, I'm open. Like, I'm listening, you know? Like, what, I think it's a question. I don't know what you find.
I mean, I have that same question. I think a lot of it is, I find something, especially in literary studies, is people who are really critical of psychoanalysis want to view texts like completely divorced from a subject, and are very into that mode of reading that is like, I just want to look at the aesthetic object and like, what does it say? But I think, you know, an aesthetic object not like always comes out of some kind of person or like a subject or something with a consciousness and an unconsciousness. And I think that's always a question that you have to ask. And I don't know. I mean, I always am wondering, like, how does this ever relate back to the fact that this is a written text? It didn't just like come out of the ocean or like land on the earth.
Right.
I have the same question as you do.
Yeah, exactly. And I think what would be interesting is to sort of really push psychoanalysis to be more attuned to the complexity of the subject. I think there is a certain fatigue with, I certainly felt it, with a kind of like rote, applied Lacanian reading of things. It's like you already know what you're looking for in advance. And there is something that can be very tiring about that if it's done in ways that are unoriginal, perhaps. But there are so many arguments about what Lacan means anyway and how to use Lacan. And these are not really settled debates. It's such an alive and dynamic field that it feels like there's so much more room to think about the subject in more challenging ways. And I think even within post-critique or some of, there are ways that psychoanalysis is seen as utterly complicit in this suspicious mode of reading. But I'm thinking of like someone like Amanda Anderson, who, is then turning to Winnicott, or Michael Snedeker, who's turning to Winnicott. I love his work. And there's a lot of room. I think, someone like Amy Allen, who writes more in critical theory as opposed to queer theory, is really interested in Melanie Klein. I think people are really newly sort of getting interested in psychoanalysis, but from other directions, because I think there is a felt need for some like new material.
And I think also, exactly what you were saying, I feel a lot of people think psychoanalysis has become a really rote method, especially in like this pop cultural way of thinking, like when you read a text, who is the father and who is the son, and he just wants to murder. And certainly you can look for those things, but I'm the same. I find that so boring. I think there's something else that you want to be looking for. And I think psychoanalysis is a way of giving us a language to look for different things and allow us to be surprised by a text.
Yeah. I think that's right. And I think we could think of like what you and I are saying as a kind of sort of more historical explanation or, contextual explanation. But I think you could also analytically, I'm sure people would say, maybe Laplanche himself would say, that it's a defense against sexuality, that in fact people are tired of dealing with psychoanalysis because they're just tired of hearing about the queerness as having anything to do with sexuality. And I'm of two minds about that. I think we haven't always been talking about sexuality in a certain way, so I'm not sure we could be defending against it, but that's part of my critique. But I do think there did get to be something very, even the way psychoanalysis was used, even by people who were trying to really reinvent the field. And, I think of Lee Edelman here. I think of Bersani. I think of even Sedgwick herself, who, I adore all of these thinkers. But I think there's a way that the things get away from us. I think there's a way that these ideas about sexuality and about the psyche have a way of turning into into concepts that are either very abstract and very far away from the erotic dimension of it. And I think maybe because it's actually very hard to think about those things or focus on these things, or as literary theorists, we don't want to do it all the time either. Like maybe it's just, I think in some sense, queer theory also has a very political dimension. It's also interested in social change. It's also interested in formulating versions of the subject that can be seen as emancipatory. That means that you kind of want, you want a theory that lends itself to those ideas. You know, Lee's use of Lacan is really so much tied up with the political purpose he wants, his own political agenda for queer theory and what he wants it to represent. And naturally, I feel like that's at the origin of the field. It's always been that. But I think that means that it could, that could also constrain us in our thinking if we're constantly trying to think about the only kind of psychoanalysis that will translate well into a certain kind of political project. So I try to focus a lot more on just the theory of subjectivity, the theory of mind that we're developing.
Yeah, well, I think that's a really good segue into thinking this. And especially because I think in one way, I think a lot of the allergic reaction almost to psychoanalysis is because of the question of the sexual. And I think a lot of people either don't want to argue for this kind of primacy or really original status of the sexual. I think, you know, Heidegger has this question, like, we've forgotten the question of being, but I think we could also say, you know, we've forgotten the question of the sexual, and it always needs to be reinvigorated. And I think that's something that queer theory always does, and says, like, this is a defining part of our lives. We have to keep thinking it. But I think there's also a big failure of people to see how the sexual can relate to things that are ostensibly not sexual. Like the gathering of bodies in a political space, or even just the political in general. So I'm wondering if you can say more about, like, what is Laplanche doing with the sexual? Because he has a very different view of this, of sex, sexuality, the sexual, etc. And maybe, like, how is this, his specific torque, able to help us think about the erotophobia and, like, how to move past that and how to kind of get beyond this phobic reaction we have to the erotic?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the major points, if not the major point, that Laplanche repeats and repeats and repeats, and that I try to do in my own critique, is that that sexuality cannot be dissociated from otherness and from the actual other person. And what he means by that is a very pointed critique of Lacan. I think Freud and Lacan maybe equally, but I think he's very aware and he's very in conversation with Lacan's discourse for obvious reasons. And, you know, I think there's a tendency within psychoanalysis that queer theory has in turn really replicated in its own formulations. And that tendency is to try to think about sexuality somehow divorced from the actual other person in our early lives. And Laplanche is saying, guess what? We only get to be sexual beings because we were taken care of as infants by other sexual beings. We wouldn't be sexual otherwise. And since we have no way of developing without getting the help of caregivers, mothers, fathers, it doesn't really matter who, he says it could be a clone. But we simply biologically cannot take care of ourselves. We're born prematurely compared to every other species. We need someone to take care of us. The fact that we need someone to take care of us means that once a caregiver enters the scene, that caregiver has a sexuality as compared to us. We are kind of like flailing, helpless. We have instincts, we have needs, but we're not born with a sexuality. But in the encounter with an actual other person who does have a sexuality, we have to sort of like very quickly, very frantically try to make sense of what is being thrown at us from this adult being. And that experience, that need to frantically make sense of things is in itself what establishes a sexuality in us. So it's exactly that, precisely that move to make sense of the encounter of another person's sexuality that instantiates a sexuality in us. And so lo and behold, like we end up sexual and we end up with a sexuality and there's no way around that. But that would be like a mini version of what Laplanche is saying. But he's also saying that Freud has a tendency to end up talking about sexuality as though it's some like, it's as though it's something we're really born with by virtue of being humans. It's some id-like force. It is the unconscious. It's just there. It's phylogenetically transmitted. It's, you know, coming from our bodies. Laplanche is like, that's nonsense. That's instinct you're talking about. Drive. Sexuality could not be automatic and inherent that way. Then he turns to Lacan and he says, you know, Lacan keeps saying that we are sort of, we have an unconscious by virtue of language. But for Laplanche, language sounds very abstract. What language doesn't give us a sexuality. It's language spoken by another person who has a sexuality. It's not just language. And so what he's consistently trying to correct for is this very subtle tendency. And I do think it's sort of subtle, but it ends up having quite big ramifications. The subtle tendency to sort of dissociate the emergence of sexuality from the actual other people it emerges from. And he's saying if we keep closing those like openings, you know, those like it keeps happening where sexuality in essence slips out of the equation. And that's because the other person gets lost in these formulations. And so if we keep bringing the other person back into it, that's the way we're going to get closer to hanging on to what we mean by sexuality. And so I think, you know, to go back to your point, your question about the social element of this, I think one thing we could say is that it's not only difficult to talk about sexuality or to think about the ways that sexuality is everywhere, as you say, in sexual objects or not, but it's also very difficult to talk about and think about other people as really impacting our consciousness. I think that is very uncomfortable. I think we like to believe that we're more autonomous and self-enclosed than we actually are. And I think that's one of the major things that sexuality presses against or, you know, pushes against, tries to overturn. So I think that's why Laplanche would characterize the constant losing sight of sexuality as a recentering. We're back to being just our like neat, enclosed, self-sufficient selves in a certain way. And I think that's the benefit of losing sexuality in the way that it keeps getting lost. I don't know if that kind of answers your question or trying to.
Yeah. So on in the book on page 18, you have this formulation that I'll just read because I really liked it. Let's see. If, however, sexuality can be enlarged beyond genitality and situated accordingly in the context of biopsychical development and relationality, sexuality leads us away from the familiar illusions about our own independence and toward the discovery of the other in us. To wit, man is not only no longer at the center of his own universe, but he is not even the primary source of his own sexuality. And this made me think of, you know, Freud, his famous like the blows to human narcissism when he talks about, you know, the Copernican revolution, we're not the center of the universe, the Darwinian revolution, we're not the center of like life, and then his blow, which is like we're not even the center of ourselves, and then, you know, Laplanche gives us another blow that our sexuality, something so central to the questions of psychoanalysis and being a subject, is not, like, we are not even at the center of our own sexuality. And I think that is an anxious or an anxiety-producing idea. Like, it's scary to think that you are so still dependent upon other people.
Right, yeah.
Even when you're grown up and your sexual relation.
Right, I exactly right. I think about, you know, my patients, or I think about my own experience in in analysis where, you know, I hear all the time from patients like, oh, come on, I can't still be affected by that. I'm like, you know, 30 something. And it's like, yes. And like, why would you think you wouldn't be? And it's like, you know, this frustration at feeling like even this thing, which is most intimate, which is most feels like me, this thing that is my desire would somehow be informed or shaped or driven by other people is, I think it's very frustrating. And I think kind of really, as you said, a blow to our own narcissism, to our own grandiosity, to our own self-sufficiency, to imagining that, that we're like this. I mean, I think it would be interesting to think about queer theory's own relationship to sexuality in those terms. Like, is queer theory itself, as much as, you know, I think you called it like an erotoskeptic, or as much as it's trying to, erotophilic, as much as queer theory is trying to put sexuality front and center, is it also defending itself against the notion that sexuality would not be something we have total control over? And why shouldn't it defend itself against that? Like, why would queer theory transcend those anxieties in some sense?
I think this is very related to a question of queer theory and as well as psychoanalysis's social function or political function or maybe an ethical function as well, that there's this opening up to the other that has to be kind of avowed. You have to say there are others. And that's actually where I derive some form of my, whatever constitutes myself. I don't know, maybe if you have like thinking on that, because I think that is such an ethical force within the book that, you know, I don't know, I'm thinking like Sartre, hell is other people, but like you have to do it. Because you can't just be a hermit. Like, you do have to see other people in so many different ways.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that's where, you know, Laplanche never tires of saying, like, you know, it does, like, you literally, functionally, you cannot develop without the encounter with another person. And this is something that Laplanche does not think about or talk about, but something very that I'm interested in, a sort of separate vein, is, you know, something that's coming out of affect theory. And affect theory, by affect theory, again, another big field that means like 10,000 different things to everyone. But I mean, you know, I'm thinking of affect theory in this vein specifically as it emerges in, like, you know, neurobiology. And you know, Adrian Johnston has written, he's written a lovely book on affect theory in relationship to Lacan, but early affect theory, more like the Damasio guys, things like this, that kind of affect theory for a moment. But, you know, affect theory is sort of at the forefront of recognizing the extent to which our development hinges, the development of our minds and our bodies hinges on our interaction with our caregivers. So we literally will not develop in the way that we need to without those interactions. I mean, this is like a huge revolution. This is like saying, it's, you know, you talk about humbling. It's like, you know, you don't just grow automatically. You don't just grow by yourself. You grow because someone is taking care of you badly, well, consistently. All those things are sort of a different realm, but someone somewhere is taking care of you in some way, or you would not develop. And I think that the fact of that I think, you know, sort of is emerging out of some of this affect stuff. And it was earlier sort of beginning to emerge out of attachment theory, but I think attachment theory really had its own problems. And so it couldn't fully develop in the way that it needed to. It couldn't develop this idea in the way that it needed to. But now what we're seeing is increasingly clear that we do need other people, and we need them for our own development. And so, you know, even when you think you're being a hermit, even when you're saying fuck the social, even when you're saying like, I want nothing to do with it. Okay. But to get here, you did engage with the social, like you can get out of, you can try to get out of it at some point later in some way, maybe, but you can't escape the social that's already in you. you can't escape that. That got in there before you had a chance to do anything about it. I think that's the kind of cruelty of it, if there is one, you know,
yeah.
And maybe what makes it kind of unbearable.
Yeah, I mean, I think, especially, so I used to be so obsessed with queer theory, and then I kind of lost it. But then maybe this is bringing me back. But I think one of the things that I really loved about queer theory when I was reading it as an undergrad was, like, a lot of it was just talking about the fact that you are always bound up with these relations that are weird, and it is weird to be with other people, but it's not something that you can ever get around or get beyond. And even if you do try to get beyond, it's because you hated it. So you have to have it. And it makes me think of this, the C.A. Conrad, a poet who has this quote in some poem or some book, I can't remember, but this idea that, you know, like dying on your deathbed alone, or like, I've had to do everything alone in my life, is just some kind of romantic fantasy of kind of the Bildung of the individual, because it's like, what the hell? You not only like you were you raised by people, or like you had friends or whatever, even if you are alone every day of your life, do you go to the store? Do you go to wherever? Do you have, like, just the idea of other people kind of allows you to live? So there's this huge interdependence, and I'm one, like, it creates the sexual. So I'm wondering how, like, the sexual is part of our normal life when we're not thinking about the sexual, and how that can take us beyond kind of this like, I don't want anything to do with it reaction.
Well, I think, I'm not sure if when you're saying that part of what turned you off from those kinds of thoughts, it had to do with the determinism. Like, was that partly what you're saying, that it just felt kind of deterministic in its own way, that if everything was already, one is so interdependent and could do nothing about it, that as a result, there was little freedom or little room for freedom. Is that partly what you're saying?
I was always about that. I turned away from queer theory for other reasons. But one of the things that I think that has fundamentally shaped my, like, my ethics and, like, looking at literature is how it was so insistent on these social relations, and how there is no such thing as, like, a monad. And even in, even if you do have, like, this quote unquote heterosexual pairing, like, it is still always founded on how it relates to other people. Like, this fantasy of just being able to be alone is exactly that. It's a fantasy. And I think relating to, like, queer modalities of life or queer existence, it's just like this whole, not just an avowal of it, but like a complete acceptance and like leaning into the fact that there are different relations and that you have relations and that you can't not.
That's right. Yeah. And I think, you know, I think that there is really an attempt in much of queer theory, sometimes deliberately, to get away from that relational dimension of it. Or alternatively, I think of someone like Lynn Huffer, of an attempt to, you know, follow what she thinks Foucault is insisting on, which is a kind of bodies and pleasures, as, you know, and Bersani does this a little bit too. I mean, for what it's worth, I think Foucault is way more ambivalent about psychoanalysis than some people would like to think. I think he's all over the place in terms of really being committed to a new version of sexuality, a new version of consciousness and subjectivity, and sort of, you know, in constant debate about that. You know, Joel Whitebook has done a great critique of Foucault from a while back, which is very interesting in this regard. And I don't. And anyway, the point is, I don't think Foucault is nearly consistent or single-minded in his relation to psychoanalysis as people make it sound. But there are people who use him to say that. Wouldn't it be great if we could have like a mode of relationality that was like surface oriented and not too deep and not too engaged with unconscious forces and not too Riven by sort of antagonisms and conflict, but was more just sensational or sensations, or, you know, I don't know bodies and pleasures. But there's a real appeal to some of these ideas, I think partly because they seem like an escape from a mode of relationality that is a lot messier, and messier because it involves like psyches and bodies that are psychological. And I think there's a real wish to get away from that. I think we see that across the field. Might go back to our earlier point about the field, but
Yeah, I mean, that's this whole idea, I think, is kind of part of your last chapter on queer relationality. And I wanna turn to a different chapter, which was, I thought, a great one. I hope everybody who reads this thinks the same thing, because it was very interesting and an intense read. It was the one on psychology as ideology, light, Butler and the trouble with gender theory. I'm wondering if you can say a little bit more, because like what you're doing in this chapter, because I think what defines gender theory and sexuality theory, I think a lot of today is this Butlerian notion, or like everything that we know about Butler, even though I think, you know, also most people either haven't read Butler in like 10 years and are talking about Butler, or like just have not read or only read Gender Trouble and then didn't actually read Undoing Gender to get the what was actually happening. But what are you trying to make in this section?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's really about this way that, you know, Butler, who, you know, in my reading is very interested in psychoanalysis and is a, sort of a, like, always using psychoanalysis to think through the subject. In fact, had a well-known debate with Laplanche when he was in the U.S. At some point in the early 2000s, I believe. And so, you know, she's definitely someone who wants to engage with this work. And I think her writing on gender is a good example of the way in which, even without intending it, or even with the best intentions, in her formulations, sexuality turns into this just very familiar version of ideology through Althusser, through Foucault, where it's sort of been evacuated of its of any sense of how of a psychology would actually work. And what she's meaning by psychology is just what is sort of like personal about you, and not necessarily reducible to the state or to culture writ large. And I think partly what I'm trying to push on is, okay, that's a very impoverished view of the psyche that you're using. I mean, you're essentially, to Butler, you know, you're using a view of the psyche that doesn't have its own mode of functioning, that isn't driven in its own way, that's just a sort of like empty vessel for the deposits of sociality. And I think that's a kind of, I mean, frankly, that's a kind of, I suppose, impoverished view of social as well, but it certainly doesn't work for how we would think about the psyche. So I think that really gets lost in her work. And I think she's really trying to theorize, in some sense, the psyche, but I think all these people are, frankly. I think that's why I chose them. It would not be very interesting to sort of choose someone who is not interested in psychoanalysis. To me, these are the people that are the most interested in psychoanalysis, that are using it the best, as far as I'm concerned. And yet, like, how does this happen? How does the psyche turn into kind of like an empty vessel, as it were?
Well, I want to ask the question, because there is this like psychological view, but then, I mean, one term that psychoanalysis always is using is metapsychological. So can you kind of talk about what this difference is and how maybe this different topography that metapsychological or metapsychological analysis gives us to talk about things? Because it is something that is so different than just a psychological analysis.
Yeah, I think what I'm trying to, and meta psychology is a very contested term within psychoanalytic theory. It doesn't really exist in the French. They kind of just do psychoanalytic theory. But in the US especially, it's a lot more contested because you had really in the late 80s, a bunch of theorists who said there is no, this word has no meaning. When we're using psychoanalysis, we're just always using Freudian psychoanalysis. And you had some other thinkers who were like, okay, but if that's how we're using it, then we never have a way of critiquing Freud. So like, we need to have a realm of theory that is sort of separate from Freud, that is just the realm of psychoanalytic theory. And Laplanche has something to say about this because I think he was, very attuned to what the debates that were going on in the US at that time between the different movements of psychoanalysis. But to me, metapsychology is an indispensable term. I think you need to have a realm of analysis that allows you to decide what works and what doesn't work for psychoanalytic theory and to apply it for the purposes of close reading. I mean, I think what you said earlier about, everyone assumes psychoanalysis is Freud and Lacan. And I think partly because there's very little sense in our analyses that we're using a particular psychoanalytic template. Partly what I encounter a lot of, I felt this a lot in graduate school, was just like, this is, I used to get into arguments with Lauren about this. Like it was very much just, this is the psyche. And I'm like, okay, no, that's the Lacanian psyche. That's not the psyche. I don't know what the psyche is, but there surely are other ways. And, there's a way that it has been, we are always using maybe Freud or Lacan without any distance or any way to critique those concepts. So I'm really just trying to introduce a method of analysis that allows us to critique it. And by breaking it down in that way, to identify where things maybe go astray or, could we make a substitution there? Is it this Lacanian notion of misrecognition that's getting us? Okay, so then like, what if we swap that out? Would this work better? Would this elucidate something more? Instead of it being sort of, to me, all together and in a very incoherent way. I don't know. Does that make sense? I think that.
Yeah, it does. And I think that was something that, I don't know, as someone who hasn't read, I'm not as familiar with Laplanche, but I think, Freud's using metapsychology, metapsychologie in the German, it's like, it is its own thing. It's not just psychology. And he's the idea that you're looking at the structure of the theory itself. And I think what's so interesting and something that you bring out is that you don't have to take what you are given. You are allowed to move out and find something else if it doesn't work for you. And I think that's something that, when people think of psychoanalysis, I think they don't realize that you are allowed to think differently. Given the idea that, Lacan's big thing is return to Freud, that maybe, anytime you work with psychoanalysis, you in a sense, you are returning to Freud, but that doesn't mean that the return has to be kind of this like faithful or loving return to the father. It can be like this critical, I'm coming home and I'm yelling at my dad kind of thing. Like it can be something else. You can overturn. And maybe like this is the deconstructionist in me, but like you can go back and then completely change whatever you've been given, or you can substitute it and do something completely else. But I think the category of the metapsychological is helpful to understand that this is a theory. This is something that's constructed and it doesn't have to be
exactly
this.
I think that's a lovely way of putting it. I think I would hope that, someone reading this would feel encouraged to find the kind of theory that makes sense for them. And if they're frustrated with, Lacan and Freud, or the people that are using Lacan and Freud, or the readings that are coming up with, like, to sort of look into alternatives or critique those modes. These are, Laplanche makes this lovely distinction between metapsychology and like the mytho-symbolic order. And what he means by that is that we are always interpreting things, and we're always coming up with, he calls it the sexual theories of children, which I love. And we're always, as this originates in childhood, trying to explain why something is happening and what it means. And so that we're doing all the time. But he says Freud makes the mistake of sometimes confusing that activity with metapsychology. So Freud thinks, oh my God, I came up with the Oedipus complex. This is actual theory. And Laplanche is like, no, Freud, that was just your way of explaining something you didn't understand. Like, A for effort, great job. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's right. And we should only count as metapsychology the theories that check out based on the standards of like theory building. And so we should be able to make some distinction between our own interpretations, which have their own function in our lives and our work, versus what we should count as sort of laws of the psyche or principles of mental functioning. And I think that distinction is very liberating. I find it liberating. I find like, oh, thank God, because some of these things are just, they're terrible. They're all, I don't want to have to be committed to some of these complexes. Like, you know, and I felt like I was ambivalent and am very ambivalent about so much of psychoanalysis. And so I need a way to navigate that ambivalence, I think I'm hoping this is one way to navigate that.
So you just bring up this idea of like, we're constantly interpreting and like, you know, we're like, psychoanalysis, if anything, is a theory of reading. And I want to ask, just because this was something that I was really interested in, was how, like, this idea of queerness as a hermeneutic. I don't know, can you open that up? Because I think, like, Sedgwick talking about, like, if you're not reading this, you're, like, not reading at all. And I think it is something that's, like, psychoanalysis is a form of reading. And queer theory does so many different readings, not necessarily on literary texts always, but, like, a way of looking. And I think, how does queerness become this meaning-making or reading-generating body or discipline? And what does it mean to read queerly or to do hermeneutics as an always queer gesture?
Yeah. I mean, I'd be very interested in your sense of that as well. I mean, I'll answer that just briefly, but I would really love to hear sort of your own, where you go with that. I think, you know, it seems to, and I think Sedgwick really comes kind of the closest in my personal canon. I think I'm just amazed constantly by her readings. And I think Sedgwick is such a good example of someone who wants to free hermeneutics of its, authoritarian dimensions, of its attempt to fix meaning in a certain way, and of its, of the tendency to foreclose possibilities. And I think one of the ways to read queerly, I think, would be to really open up texts to possibilities that really don't necessarily conform to our presuppositions of them, but to see them as like dynamic entities that might provoke us in ways that we don't anticipate. So maybe a mode of receptivity in some sense, I think. Yeah, I'm really curious, where did you go with it, or what were you thinking? You're interested in the question of hermeneutics. I know from other times I've listened to your interviews.
I was really interested in Sedgwick's kind of, I mean, always, you're so paranoid, you probably think this essay is about you, I think is kind of like a fundamental text, and I think it's great. And I was really interested in, you know, this idea of queerness, or of maybe sexuality in general, of like being open to the other, or like always having to come from the other. And I think that that's what reading is. Like, you are never reading, I mean, as a person who reads literary texts, like, those are always coming from someone else. So I think inherent within reading is kind of this erotic mingling with the other. But even I was thinking as I was reading this, like, what does it mean to read my own work? And to see, you know, not only is my own work always informed by the other authors I have been reading at the time, or whoever's class I'm in, or like even when I was an undergrad, like I used to have professors tell me that my writing always just sounded like whoever I was writing about. So there was that trace or that stamp of the other on me. But even if I'm reading a paper that I wrote, which I just did, and I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I read that. But that's like someone else. That's like a different person. That's me 2 years ago. That's me a month ago. That's whatever. So reading is always this opening onto an other that kind of creates this, oh my God, that creates some kind of relationship with otherness that you have to figure out. And it's always this kind of weird, I don't want to put it into like a martial metaphor. So it's, I wouldn't say it's like a battle. It's almost like a dance or something. It's this, I have to constellate and figure out how I am in relation to you and where do I appear. And I think that's part of the fun of reading for me.
Yeah. And, but the anxiety of it too. And I think this is something that, you know, one way we can understand the kind of appeal of this like post-critical moment. I mean, I think there's a real anxiety involved in reading because you can be surprised or you can be, you have to feel open or be open to read in a certain way. Otherwise, it's very hard to take something in. You know, I can't read when I'm upset. Yeah. You know, I'm like, I can't, you know, I'm like too taken up by being upset. So there's a certain way that you need to be receptive to the other. And I think that's very hard to sustain. And I think part of the way psychoanalysis has been mobilized against reading has been in the way that Marxism has been mobilized against it, to sort of just function as we already know the outcome, as a something, a unified theory that you can apply and move on. And I, you know, everything can be used that way. And I, psychoanalysis, and certainly in its earlier iterations, wanted to be used that way in some sense. So there's a lot to work against, I think, in terms of those tendencies.
Yeah. I mean, the whole, I was thinking about this for a paper last year, but like when you're reading a poem and it has a really regular meter, and then at some point just like switches, and that terrifying moment of like, oh fuck, I don't know how to read this. Like there's this idea that someone else is moving within you. And I don't know, that there is this erotic dimension. There is this like, we're moving in some kind of formation that I'm not totally sure what's happening, because it breaks down this idea of me as like this autonomous reading subject who's holding a book and there's no one else here, when in reality there is someone else there. And I don't know, I'm thinking like the Lacanian, there is no sexual relationship. Like there, what kind of relationship happens in reading?
Yeah.
Is there a sexual, that's what I was thinking of.
Yeah. I think that's something related to something you were saying earlier too, about the ways that, you know, a kind of anti-humanist, anti-subject reading wants to sort of almost believe that the book emerges, like you said, from the ocean or like falls from the sky, you know, like it's sort of denial of that erotic element to it. Mm-hmm. Also, or where would it come from? It's not a function of language in and of itself. It's a function of sexuality being transmitted, communicated, conveyed. Yeah.
Yeah. It is this, I mean, reading, I think people always just want it to be this really cerebral act, but it is bodies and pleasures, or it has such a toll on you. I mean, I don't know, like there's so many times when I've like cried while reading for class, just because it's taking over you. And I think that is such a scary thing about reading. But that's part of its erotics. It's this kind of relinquishing of the self to the other.
Yeah. And the voice of the text too, like how idiosyncratic every voice is too, you know. Mm-hmm. We can't even talk about it without talking about these words that convey the sort of erotic dimension of it, it seems to me. Mm-hmm.
Well, I have one final question, which is, what are you thinking about now? Do you have anything you're working on specifically that you can, you know, talk about?
I'm sort of knee deep in thinking about the relationship, you know, that like stage in your thinking where you're just like reading and you don't even know what you think anymore. That's where I'm at. So I'm going to try to make some sense of it, but I in have, you know, sort of at the stage where that, at that stage, but I'm thinking a lot about actually sort of the, a little bit the relationship between queer theory and critical theory. And by critical theory, I mean more like Frankfurt School type critical theory. And in some sense, you know, that is also the origin of a lot of queer theory, but it kind of split off into two, because queer theory took on, you know, like Adorno and company, but then critical theory, especially in Germany, you know, followed more Habermas and became the second and third and fourth generation of critical theory. And those fields really don't talk to each other anymore. But I'm thinking a lot about, you know, Berlant's notion of cruel optimism in particular, which, you know, has a lot of people have been posting a lot about it, especially this summer when she died. So many people were talking about cruel optimism everywhere. And it sort of got me thinking a lot about, you know, how do we think about a concept like cruel optimism? Again, to use metapsychology, like what is the psychological framework that undergirds a concept like cruel optimism? You know, it's using a lot of Lacan for sure, and Adorno. So trying to like deconstruct a little bit what that formulation means, and if there are ways to challenge it a little bit, get some space to open up the phrase a little bit more, I think is something I'm thinking a lot about. So I would say, extending some of this work into maybe the domain of critical theory more broadly, in addition to queer theory. I'd like them to talk to each other maybe a little bit more, because, you know, critical theory is having this moment now where it's like, oh my God, we should read more psychoanalysis. Like, you know, they have not been reading psychoanalysis for the past, like, you know, however many 40 years. Some people have, but mostly it's all been like Habermasian communication theory. And they're like, oh, this is not so bad. So it's like having a kind of like renaissance of psychoanalysis a little bit. And so but they're also running into some of the same debates of queer theory. So I'm sort of, a long way of saying that's something I'm interested in now, I guess.
Yeah. Well, that sounds really interesting. And I hope it turns into something and I can read it as soon as possible. Because that's something I once upon a time was really trying to think about. Especially I don't like the Frankfurt School, and trying to think about their relationships with sexuality. And psychoanalysis, especially because, you know, like Marcuse was so interested in, and all of these figures were so, they were right there. Like, I don't know, you think about Germany at that time, they were all thinking at the same time, in the same place. And then, I don't know, from 80 years away, it's much easier to distance them, but they were all in the same place.
Yeah. And asking so many of similar questions, like what's the vision of like an emancipatory subject, how do we do that, where's the repression coming from, what transgression is possible, so many of these questions. But I think that's partly how I got interested in it.
Well, as I said, I'm excited to see that come out in whatever form it does, and thank you for talking to me. This was a wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much, Britt. I really appreciate it. You're a really generous interlocutor.
Thank you. So once again, I was talking to Gila Ashtor about her new book, Homo Psyche, on queer theory and erotophobia. It is out. Oh my gosh, who published? Fordham University Press. It came out earlier this year. Thank you for talking. I'm Britt Edelin for the New Books Network. Until next time. Thank you.